Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, October 30th, 2016. This is episode 1336. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Jira Service Desk from Atlassian. Jira Service Desk delivers everything your IT team needs out of the box at a cost-effective price. For a free 7-day trial of Jira Service Desk, visit Atlassian.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, and all that razzmatazz. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. 888-827-5536. 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S., or should you please, Canada, if you're not in those areas, not in North America. Well, I guess you need to use Skype to reach us. Same number would work, though, with Skype out, and it would still cost you nothing. 888-827-5536. The website, techguylabs.com, I think that's a good place for you to keep in mind it because the phone number's there. A link to our chat room at irc.twit.tv is there. And, of course, all the previous shows, audio and video, and questions and answers from all those shows in text as well. And that way, if you hear something, you can don't have to write it down. You can just run on over to the website, and you'll have all the information, all the links, everything. TechGuyLabs.com. Well, it's so funny to watch Apple at work. Thursday, Apple had an event. They announced three new MacBook Pros, and it was following on a Wednesday event from Microsoft, in which Microsoft kind of took a cue, I think, from Apple and said, we're going to go after the creative professionals. They announced that they were going to name the next update to Windows, the spring update to Windows 10, was going to be the Creative Edition, and they announced a new computer called the Microsoft Surface Edition. Studio. So confusing. The Microsoft Surface Studio, designed for creatives, 28-inch touch, beautiful big touch screen, and not only a pen that you could draw with pressure sensitive, but also a little dial that had some interesting applications when you put it on the screen, and really aimed at the photographer, the graphic designer, the architect, the artist, that kind of a crowd, which is certainly not something Microsoft hasn't aimed at for before, but it's always been, everybody's always felt, I've felt, certainly, that was Apple's territory, right? So Apple announced the next day three new MacBook Pros. And as is often the case, and it happens to me too, I'm sitting watching the event and you get more and more excited. I even ordered them. Of course, I had to order them to review them, but I ordered them. And everybody's all excited and glowing after Tim Cook and Phil Schiller and the Apple executive team and come out. And I don't think Johnny Ive was in evidence, was he? Maybe he did a voiceover for one of the videos, maybe. And they really, got you going about this beautiful new MacBook Pros. They're faster, they're thinner, they're lighter. And they have these, instead of a function key row, they have this little screen, a little thin, long screen that goes where the function keys would go. And it can, because it's a screen, it's an OLED computer screen, can have different buttons there. So it can be function keys, but it can be much more, depending on what program you're using. Well, that's kind of interesting. Kind of neat. And a giant, the trackpad, big as the iPhone now. Big as the iPhone 7 Plus now. I mean, it's big. Bigger than that, I think. And as usual, the reality distortion field, that's what we call it, the RDF, created originally by Steve Jobs and now by his successors, kind of wafts over you and you go, oh, that's pretty. And I'm sure Apple hopes we'll buy immediately. But now it's interesting. In the days following, some of that's worn off for people. And I'm starting to see articles. Well, here's one that's being passed around the most from a guy named Owen Williams. He's writing on Medium in a Medium section called Charged Posts. Apple just told the world it has no idea who the Mac is for. And I'm hearing this from other quarters too, programmers, developers, designers. Last night's Apple event was bizarre, right? So, and I had been anticipating the show for a while, as we all had, right? Because it's been a year and a half or more since the MacBook Pro was updated. Apple hasn't updated its Mac Pro, the cylinder, in 3 years. iMac is a year old. People are feeling, I think, like Apple's kind of ignoring the Macintosh platform that frankly got us to this point. And, you know, you can't really blame them from a business point of view. The iPhone is such a huge business for them, makes so much money for them, everything else pales, especially Macintosh. I had been anticipating, Owen writes, for a long time, mostly looking forward to being able to stop telling people not to buy a Mac. I've been telling you that too, right? Whenever there's an Apple event, we say, don't buy a Mac. Everything's so outdated. But even though what I saw was interesting, it feels like Apple has lost his way, he says. And, you know, I'm not sure I disagree. For instance, these MacBook Pros aren't really, that's just a name. That's a marketing term. They aren't really for graphics professionals because they top out at 16 gigs of RAM. Apple says, well, that's for battery life. But if you're working with Photoshop, you probably realize 16 gigs is the absolute bare minimum. You'd sure like twice that or even more. They've eliminated ports that many pros like. The SD card reader, that's gone. Not only that, but the MagSafe adapter's gone. The USB ports are gone. If you wanted to plug your new iPhone into your new Mac, you'd have to buy an adapter because there's no USB port. You'd have to buy a Lightning to USB to Type-C, the new USB port. Now, that's admittedly the future, and they did put four of them on there, and they're very fast. But and they left the here's a weird one. They left the headphone jack on. I thought that was an old-fashioned, obsolete technology, Apple. So now I need to use either a different headphones or an adapter to use the headphone jack on both my Mac and my my phone. What? That's strange. The real problem, I think, is that Apple has said, we don't think anybody wants a touchscreen. Steve Jobs said it first. He said, you don't want to reach out in front of you. He called them gorilla arms, having to hold your arm in the air, touching the screen. Of course, they have touchscreen iPhones and iPads, but they said nobody on the desktop wants touchscreen. And now I think you could safely say they were wrong. They were wrong because we've got touch on even Chromebooks have touch. And, of course, Windows 10 has touch. Most laptops sold on Windows nowadays have a touchscreen. Graphics professionals love it. And this new Surface, this Surface Studio, this 28-inch Surface, is touch. It doesn't need a special function key replacement because it's touch everywhere. It touches everything. And so if you believe in touch, you might wonder, well, what is Apple up to? What are we seeing here? And I think what's happened, unfortunately, for Apple is that they've decided that nobody wants touch, wrongly. And they made that commitment a while ago. And they haven't updated their operating system, OS, Mac OS, to support touch. And that's a lot of work. I'm sure somebody somewhere is doing it. And you know, in a year or two, Apple will triumphantly announce, we've discovered touch. We're bringing you touch finally. And we can all be happy. But at this point, I think, believe it or not, and I'm hearing from a lot of creative professionals, for the first time in my memory, programmers, designers, artists are looking at Windows instead of Macintosh because they want the touch. And Apple's kind of eliminating the low end. You know, they don't have anything under $1,300 you can buy now. No computer under $1,000, and there's plenty of PC choices with touch under that in every respect are as good as, maybe even better than the MacBook Pros. with more RAM available and so forth. So it's interesting. What do you think? Did Apple miss the boat here? Are you going to happily buy the new MacBook Pros? 8888, Ask Leo. Let's talk about it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, Ask Leo. I like starting the day with a visit down under to Melbourne, Australia. We go, and Alan is on the line. Hi, Alan.
G'day, Leo. How are you?
G'day. Is it morning? Is it night?
Yeah, it's 20 minutes past 5
a.m. in the morning. Holy cow. Well, good morning is right.
Leo, I have a bit of an issue with my computer. I've Googled the problem, and I still really can't find the answer, but it's quite common. NVIDIA. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
NVIDIA. NVIDIA.
NVIDIA.
NVIDIA.
It's crashing on a regular basis.
Yeah, me too. I got a crashing NVIDIA too. Are you using Windows 10?
No, Windows 7 actually.
Windows 7. So I have a high-end computer that I use for virtual reality. And of course, as required by Oculus and Vive, it's got an NVIDIA video card in it, the 970. And as soon as the Windows 10 update came out, it started crashing all the time, blue screening on me. Anytime. When does it blue screen on you?
Well, it doesn't. It black screens, and it's making like reverb audio. Sometimes it's restoring, and it's coming up with a little message in the bottom right-hand corner saying that it recovered from a crash.
Yeah.
Blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But most times when I'm watching HD video, it will just go black, and the audio will, make terrible screeching noises and stuff like that.
So let me just explain why that's happening. The audio making sound really tells you something. What it is a bad driver, a driver with a bug. And when one of the things that's a really bad thing to do, but happens all the time, it's one of the most common bugs of all, is writing to portions of memory that you don't control. In this case, writing to the sound buffers. So it's putting random data into the sound buffers. The sound card's then playing it, and it sounds horrible, of course.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
So that's a sign. When something like that happens, like when your screen goes dark and then jumps around and the sound goes, that's a sign that something in software is writing to the wrong area of memory. Now, the only thing that can do that is Windows itself or a driver. What we call, they're system level applications. Applications that are running in the user portion of memory don't have permission to change other programs' buffers. So that kind of error won't happen, when a program crashes. But when a driver crashes, it can. So we know it's a driver issue. I'm sure it's an NVIDIA driver issue. In fact, I think, as I remember, NVIDIA has pushed out a couple of driver updates just in the last week. So they've got something wrong. So video, what you need to do is update your video driver. Now, here's the problem. You don't know which one's going to work, right?
Right, yeah.
So when you get an NVIDIA card, NVIDIA is an interesting kind of a company. They're they're like ARM. They're a fabless designer. They make a design for video chips, and then other companies will license it. So you don't usually get a video card from NVIDIA unless you're getting some sort of review or reference card. You're getting it from another company, ASUS. Or, I can't remember. There's a lot of companies that use the NVIDIA designs. So what that means is there is a multitude of NVIDIA drivers. The driver is the software that tells Windows how to talk to the video card. A poorly written driver causes exactly these symptoms. The problem is, which one should you use, especially since NVIDIA seems to be pumping them out at this point, trying to fix whatever's gone on. So there's at least four current drivers for any NVIDIA card. There is the NVIDIA reference driver, and that's one NVIDIA writes and gives to everybody who uses NVIDIA chips to do a video card. There's the driver created by the manufacturer of the video card that is designed based on the NVIDIA reference driver, but may or may not be different. Usually is somewhat different. So that's two. There's the one you would get from Windows Update. Usually that's an older one that was submitted either by NVIDIA or by the card manufacturer for Windows Hardware Quality Lab certification. Now, WHQL certification usually means that that's the best of the bunch, but it's not going to be the fastest of the bunch, and it's not going to be the most recent of the bunch because card companies don't submit their drivers every time. It costs too much. It's a lengthy process. So they might submit one every year or so to the Microsoft for certification. So there'll be an NVIDIA driver. There'll be a company driver. There'll be a company WHQL driver, and there'll be the Windows Update driver. And some or all of them may have this bug. Sometimes if they all do, then you have to go back to an earlier version. I use the NVIDIA software, and I'm sure you have that installed. It's installed usually with the card. And the NVIDIA software will download the appropriate driver. But you may end up saying, that's not going to work, so you're going to go to your manufacturer. And thank you, Archandra, for providing me some names. MSI, Gigabyte, XFX, EVGA, PNY, Zotac, and I mentioned Asus. They all make NVIDIA video cards. So figure out who made yours. Go to their site, get their latest drivers, get Microsoft's latest driver, get NVIDIA's latest driver, and figure out which one works best for you. Generally, Windows Update's going to use the certified driver, right? That'd be the oldest, but it might be the most stable. And NVIDIA also makes, and this is probably a good idea, a tool for uninstalling all the other stuff and starting over. So this is my first advice to you, is to get the NVIDIA cleanout tool. Thank you, Rusty Bones. We'll put a link at techguylabs.com for that. You can find it at NVIDIA.com. It'll clean out all the driver bits and install the latest one. That's the first thing I would do. I'm facing the same thing. And, you know, I just kind of gave up. I threw up my hands. I have, you know, this really nice machine running, HTC Vive virtual reality and the Oculus Rift virtual reality. It was great. It was wonderful. And then I did Windows Update, you know, in August when Microsoft did the big update. Everything stopped working. Anytime I try to do the 3D stuff, the virtual reality stuff, blue screen to death. Every time. And I have to reboot. And finally, I just turned it off and said, I'll come back to you later. So now it's time, two months later, probably to see if there's a better driver. This is not unusual. So clean out the old drivers, install the newest one from NVIDIA, and if that doesn't work, try your manufacturer. If that doesn't work, try Microsoft. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Greg in Los Angeles is... No, I'm sorry. Yeah, Greg in Los Angeles is next. Hi, Greg. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. That was a close call.
Yeah. Almost hung up on you. No, I wouldn't have. I just would have put you second.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That's fine. I will ask you my question directly and then tell you my symptoms and what happened after that, and you can tell me what you need.
Okie dokie.
So, question is, can a dashboard mount... or my phone that uses a magnet as opposed to a clip, can that affect the GPS feature in my phone?
No.
Well, thank you.
So this is a common question because a lot of devices now have magnets. I use a case from a company called Rockform that has an extremely strong rare earth magnet in the back, and that way I can, you know, put it on metal surfaces. I can mount it in my car. Logitech makes a one-touch device that clips on, and I've seen others that clips onto your vent and has a very powerful magnet on it, and then you put a metal plate on your phone. To my knowledge, after using this kind of stuff for a long time and trying it for a long time, I have not seen any issues at all with big old magnets and smartphones. I suppose it would screw up your compass because that is magnetic.
So that's exactly what I was hoping to hear, and in fact, the minimal research I did online seemed to bear out the same. So then let me briefly tell you what happened, and then we can take it from there.
Okay.
So I had an iPhone 6, and right about the same time, I got this magnet mount, and I upgraded to iOS 10. And then when I would use the Waze app, within a couple of days of that, when I would use the Waze app, it would lose GPS.
That's no good.
Various places, and then for no apparent reason, it would regain it. You know, not rebooting or anything, literally just driving blindly.
Does it do that with other map apps as well, or is it?
Yes. Okay. It did it with the Apple. It's a with the maps. With the
GPS
maps.
Is funny because it's really line of sight to the satellite. So it is possible. You know, indoors, as you probably know, GPS does not work, and it's possible in your car that depending on which satellites is using it, may come and go. When you
so that was my thought as well, but it was really I drive all over the place for work, and it was. You know, miles and miles and miles away from each other where it would happen, and completely intermittently.
Yeah.
So I then got an iPhone 7 now, unrelated to that. It was just my time. And I've been hesitating to use the magnet mount in case that was the issue.
Well, if it does affect it, it won't affect it permanently. So, it's of course possible to block the GPS radio, so you might try the magnet in other locations. You know, the iPhone is funny because Apple really likes to use metal, and metal blocks radios. So the metal iPhone blocks both the cellular phone radio and the GPS radio. They have to put little plastic bands in places so that it can get out. You want to be careful not to accidentally block those. In other words, the phone is actually not transparent to the radios. So you have to. That's why Google, with its latest phone, has a big glass panel on the top for the radios to get out, because it can't get past the metal. And Apple, you remember, until recently used glass. In fact, the rumor is strong that they're going to use glass again on the next iPhone. But as long as they're using aluminum unibody. And what they did with the new phone, as you notice, is there's no longer a plastic strip. If you look at your previous iPhone, there was a weird plastic bar around it. And they seem to have, I mean, obviously they have some sort of exit for the radio. I'm not sure where they've put it now. I think it's kind of hidden on the side.
I'll give it a try.
Yeah, just move it. In other words, move it around in the magnetic mount if you can. Position it differently in the car if you can. The good news is the magnet's not doing it.
Okay. All right. Good. That was the main.
The metal in that case, or the metal in the magnet, may be shielding it. So I would move it around.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. We've sacrificed. I don't know if you remember the early days of cell phones, they had extendable antennas. Remember that? And they would always break. You'd look kind of dopey. But the antennas made a difference. That made a much better connection for you. And what's happened is we've sacrificed connectivity for looks. First, we moved the antenna into the phone itself, and that definitely reduced the signal strength. They've done a lot, of course, to make these radios more sensitive, which helps. And then, of course, we moved to digital. When we had those extensible antennas, we were probably, I would bet, almost all analog still. And once we moved to digital, at first it was terrible. Remember, I don't remember that. There was a lot of dropouts. You would just lose the signal. But they've improved that. And I'm not sure if that's, in fact, if somebody works for a cellular company, I'd love to hear the story here. Is that because the cellular companies have put in more cell towers, or is it because the phones have gotten more sensitive or somehow improved reception? But anytime you have a radio inside a metal case, you've got a problem. So Apple in the past has put little escape vents, plastic escape vents. I'm told they're still on this phone, but I'm looking at my iPhone 7 Plus, the glossy black one, and I don't see any plastic on it at all. So I don't know where the... maybe it's up at the top. There's a little, you barely see it, a little plastic thing on either side at the top. That is much smaller air real estate and would be much easier to block. Remember the iPhone 4 which was a glass front and back. But in order to make the antenna work better, they had a metal frame all the way around it. And that was actually the antenna. And if you held it in certain ways, it would, the signal would drop. It would attenuate the signal because you were blocking the antenna. Actually, you were, it wasn't even blocking it. You were shorting it out. So, you, and Steve Jobs' response was, oh, you're just holding it wrong. And eventually, they put out a plastic bumper to go around that metal antenna. So we've had, this is not unusual, these antenna problems. By the way, fun fact, your GPS can continue to work in the air because it's a passive receiver. It's not a broadcaster. So airplanes don't, it doesn't affect air. And it, even though when you go in airplane mode, sometimes that turns off your GPS. If you can turn your location back on. And Johnny Jett told me a couple of months ago about a great app called Flyover Country. And I used it just the other day as we flew over the U.S. If you turn that on, it'll use your GPS. And then if you look down, it'll tell you about geographic formations below you. Geologic, I'm sorry, and geographic. Terrain below you. What you're seeing there is some stratigraphy there from the Mesozoic era. How about that, huh? It's kind of cool. And it's really fun if you're one of those people who looks out the window of the plane and going, I wonder where we are right now. You can look at your phone and get a very detailed image of exactly what you're flying over. That GPS isn't a transmitter, it's just a receiver. But like any radio, you can block it if you block those little plastic ports. I kind of wonder if Google's Pixel will be better because it does have that glass panel about a third of the way down the back of it, specifically for the antennas. 8888 Ask Leo. We are going to talk, by the way, photography in 45 minutes. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, I think we're doing a review. A review of your photos. We'll also answer more of your calls when we come back. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Judy is in Coppell, Texas. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Leo. I listen to your podcast usually when I'm out walking 5 or 6 miles in the morning, so happy to talk to you in person.
Wow, that's great.
Or
that's
whatever.
That's a healthy habit. I like it. I should do that.
Right. Well, it passes the time.
Why don't you do a podcast and I'll listen to your podcast in the morning when I walk?
Sure.
Turnabout is fair play.
Right. Well, I have a backup issue, and I'm a pretty good person to back up. I've got good. Windows 10 home, good. And I back up every week using my Western Digital 2 terabyte drive.
Good.
And I also take a Windows 7 backup and restore snapshot. And monthly, I take another one, but I do not have an off-site one. So I have, but what I have is I do not use the, and I have Windows 10. I do not use the users file much. I have a big directory structure, oddly enough, called Judy. And in there is about 800 folders and about 14,000 different files.
So your data, and, you've segregated into this Judy folder.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's not, well, that's the problem. It's not just data. It's basically my life. And one of those.
That's folders, what you want to back up. Back up your life.
I want to do it all at one whack. I want to check that thing and have an offsite deal do it. Now, one of the things I do have is a subdirectory called download, which, as you can imagine, has a lot of exes and other things.
Right.
And I
have, you don't want to back that up. You never want to back that
yes,
up.
Yes, I do. I do. I do because I have some old tools that I can never get back. It's all part of this big giant blob that I wanted to do.
Those are the apps that you installed and you want to have around in case somebody.
Right, yeah. And I have some INIs and some dot. I have a bunch of things like that. But I've talked to the Carbonite people who are absolutely wonderful.
Good.
Superior customer support. Unfortunately, what they told me is that then they'll be happy to back up my Judy folder. But the bad news is they will exclude all XCs, INIs, and all kinds of other, about 30 different file types because they believe it's operating system, which, of course, mine is not. So I'm wondering if in your experience, if there are people that can say, hey, can I get this done by some offsite vendor? I'd like to have versioning.
I think before we go much farther,
yeah.
You can back up anything on Carbonite. It's just that the default is not to back up EXEs.
Well, unfortunately, and I went through that with them, and I talked to a gentleman, and there's something that says backup files of this file type or something. You know, you check that, and he said it is never going to let you check an EXE file type.
Really?
That's what they said, and I thought it was, and I gave them excellent support, customer support, but I felt like they had limited thinking. So they think it's an operating system, then it's not. So you can also do a mirror image type thing, which does back up every single thing, but, and you can use it to restore on that computer, but you can't use it to restore on a new one for obvious reasons, nor can you get Judy back from that one?
I am looking at a Microsoft Knowledge Base article, and I think it's the personal, you know, the other backups. They have many plans. The other backup plans will let you do anything, but I see that they will not let you back up registry files, EXE files, files, and you know, for most people that makes sense. But I understand you want to back it up. So there's a couple of things you could do. One thing, of course, you could zip it up. And Carbonite would back it up.
And that's about a 25 gig right now.
See, this is my larger concern about offsite backup for you. Remember, it uses your upstream bandwidth to back up. And I think sometimes people like to back up terabytes of data over Carbonite. And what they're going to find is it's going to take months, if not years, to back up because Carbonite doesn't want to take up all of your upstream bandwidth.
Of course. Right.
And so generally, any online backup is really recommended only for a smaller subset of your data, a gigabyte or two. More than a gigabyte, I would say then the best way to do offsite backup is to get a second drive and put it in a safe deposit box or bring it to work, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, and I'm retired, and I thought about the safe deposit box. Also, our disks are in the safe. Both of my hard are in our
fireproof. That's great. And if they're fireproof safe, that's pretty good.
Well, it's good for two things. It's good except for the situation that somebody breaks in and they take
and they steal
the
safe.
And the safe. Now I'm toast.
Yeah.
But what I could do is put one of those hard drives in another room, in a drawer. I mean, nobody cares about a hard drive. So I would have some safety there.
Yeah, or find somewhere.
I could let Carbonite do what it'll do.
Yeah, surely.
You know,
I love the idea of, because this Judy is your life, you don't have to do it very often. But I love the idea of getting two external drives that are, you know, big enough to hold Judy several times. You can really, what I would suggest doing, the other thing that concerns me is that once a week thing. In between, stuff's going to change and you're not going to have a copy of it.
No, so that you're absolutely
I'd get a
that's a risk I've assumed.
Well,
I know that.
We can solve this. So connect this, get two terabyte or four terabyte hard drives. They are cheap now. And connect them via USB to your computer. Then get a program I like, and I use a program called Second Copy. It's from Centered Systems. It runs in the background and automatically keeps Judy on your internal drive synchronized with Judy on this external drive. And just let that go periodically. I mean, it's always running, I should say. And so you will have basically what you want is a duplicate of Judy so that no matter what, at any given time, you've got everything backed up there. You can set it, and I recommend this with synchronization programs, this is why you want a bigger drive than Judy, is to not delete files on the backup. So even if you delete a file internally on Judy, it stays in the backup, right? That way you have versions and previous versions.
No, and I agree. I do want versions, and that's why I really liked the idea of Carbonite.
Well, versioning is great, but you can do it this way manually. And then every month, take the old Judy, you know, put it somewhere. Go to your church. There must be somewhere. Safe deposit box. There must be somewhere you could bring a drive, the potting shed, somewhere. Yeah. And just once a month, swap those. And the first time you do it, the second copy will go, oh, there's a lot of different stuff. I got to quickly back up everything. And that new drive that you just brought in there will be up to date. That's one way to do it. There is, by the way, there are plans for Carbonite that will let you do exactly what you want to do. It's just, including send them a hard drive. You can send them a hard drive, you know.
Well, right, but this is the one that says,
here's what I would do. You back up Judy, you send them the hard drive, and now they're just going to do changes. So that can easily be done in real time. This is the key with Carbonite, that first backup, however many gigabytes that is, that's the thing that takes a while. That's why they give you that 2-week free trial, because that's the first thing.
But you know what? But I have the time. I mean, I'm not expecting to be in a fire or get robbed or anything.
Right.
But then, you know, I would
look at, and we should mention, I should have mentioned this right up front, Carbonite is a sponsor. Take whatever I say with a grain of salt.
And that is one reason that I called, and I listen to Security Now also.
Oh, good.
I'm a big fan of Steve.
And there are other choices, to be fair. There are other choices for offsite backup. There are lots of them. And so
apparently most of them do not allow you to do.
They all have the same.
They're not interested in taking it. So I've wasted enough of your time.
No, you haven't. This is what I would do. I would look for a plan that will, if you send them a hard drive, you can send the EXEs and all of that stuff. Put that on a hard drive. Now you're not going to be uploading hundreds of gigabytes or a terabyte of data to them. You're only going to be uploading anything that's changed to them.
Okay.
So I think this is not – now, this is a pricey solution. So we've given you a few ways to do this.
Yeah, right.
And then there's other companies. I don't do ads for them only because they come and go. So there was Mosey, there was SugarSync, there was Backblaze, and they come and go, and I don't. Carbonite's the only one that I've really been with forever, and I know that they're going to stay there forever. So,
and they give good encryption and all that.
Yeah, they do everything you want it to do. Yeah.
Well,
I should charge them for an ad here.
and I had great, excellent, very fast response.
But the thing to keep in mind is, and you know this, getting the most important data somewhere besides your premises, whether it's home or office, really is the last critical piece of a backup plan. And I'm glad you're thinking about it, Judy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Somebody says in the chat room that Backblaze will do EXE files. The reason Carbonite says they don't want to is because it can interfere. They don't want to copy a virus, I think. But it can, they can interfere with their backup as well. So,
what was the name of it?
Backblaze. That's another one. A lot of geeks use that one. The other thing is, if you're geeky, so I'm going to tell you this.
Yes, I am.
Yes. Lots of people who are more geeky, I wouldn't recommend it for a general audience, use Amazon's Glacier backup. Amazon has a very affordable backup that is designed to be cheap but slow to restore, because basically what they do is they move it offline. But it's very inexpensive, and you can mail them a hard drive as well. And I bet you that Glacier will back up anything, because it's really designed to be, as they say, a secure, durable, and extremely low-cost cloud storage for long-term backup.
So you'd
be patient. You'd say, well, I know it's going to take them 5 days to get me my data, but I know it's safe. And that's the difference. Yeah. That's what you're not paying for instant restore. See, Carbonite's designed for, if you're a business, you're not going to wait 5 days to get back in business,
But I would
look at Glacier.
Okay, I did talk to Amazon, and they said, but maybe I talked to the wrong people in Amazon, and they said they don't do XEs either.
A lot of them won't, because but Glacier, I believe, allows you to send them a hard drive, and I think you can archive anything. I would ask Amazon about Glacier.
I will do that.
This is really intended for, as it implies, cold storage of your data, right?
Right, and that's
what you want.
As long as you understand, that's what I'm willing.
You have hot storage. You have online storage, and that's what you'll use 99% of the time. But this is the it's like when they've stored all the world's seeds in that safe up in the Arctic, in case the worst happens. You've got it up there in the glacier.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Uh-huh.
All right, Judy. Bye-bye. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet, home theater, digital photography. In fact, Chris Marquardt coming up in half an hour. Smartphones, smart watches, virtual reality, headgear, autonomous vehicles, anything techie, geeky. That's what we talk about on this show. It's the Geek Show. But I am a geek, but I try to talk like a normal human being. Sometimes fail, but I'm doing my best. I'm working on English. So if you want to know what all of this stuff means, 888-ASK-LEO. That's what we're here for. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Skype will work if you're outside that area. Back to the phones, Kyle from Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Kyle.
Hello.
Hello, Kyle. How are you?
I'm doing good.
What can I do for you?
Yeah, I got a voice over IP problem, and I have an Umatello, and every time I call a landline, it echoes back at me.
This happens to us once in a while as well on the radio show. And I have yet to figure out what that is. I have theories, however. So you have an UMA, which is a great solution. It's a peer-to-peer-based voice over IP product. I better explain all of that stuff. I said we were to speak English here, right? So instead of using plain old telephone service, sometimes they call it POTS service, which, by the way, nowadays is probably also a VoIP product. You're using data instead of the phone. And you use data. That's what Skype is. That's what Magic Jack is. It uses your internet connection to place phone calls. UMA's really an interesting take on this. And people get great results with UMA. It's a little bit different than some of the other solutions because it's a peer-to-peer network. So you have to buy some UMA hardware that plugs into your internet and gives you a regular style phone to make phone calls with. And then one of the reasons I didn't talk much about UMA when it first started is because it was dependent on others having UMA. The more people who use UMA, the better the results are from UMA. And I think it's still using that peer-to-peer network. Skype was originally that. Skype was designed by the same guys who did Kazaa, which was a peer-to-peer music file sharing system, Napster style. And they went from Kazaa to doing Skype. Since then, the peer-to-peer element's been completely removed from it. Microsoft now runs the Skype servers. When you use Skype, you're kind of using their servers instead of sharing bandwidth with everybody. A peer-to-peer network means that everybody who uses the UMA kind of contributes to everybody else who uses the UMA. You're using borrowing internet connectivity from all the other UMA users. And that can really improve things because calls can be more reliable. They can be routed better. It gives you a whole mesh network instead of a point-to-point connection, which really can be better. And I think UMA does a very good job of it. The echo, though, happens with a variety of voice over internet solutions. And we get it on our phone system because our phone system is a voice over internet solution. We use a Telos VX. And occasionally, if you're listening to the show, you'll hear echoes. And, UMA stopped using peer-to-peer. Never mind. There must be an issue with peer-to-peer. I'm just looking at the Wikipedia article. Thank you, PC Guy 8088. They stopped using that peer-to-peer. See, it was one of those things where I wasn't going to recommend it until there were enough people using it for it to make sense. And then in January 2008, they stopped doing it. No, never mind. Doesn't mean that it has anything to do with, just like Skype, that it has anything to do with the Echo. The Echo, is a problem. In fact, even on Skype, they used to have a button that said echo cancellation. The echo is a problem of your voice coming back to you slightly delayed, right? That's echo. That's what an echo is. Hello, hello, hello. Your voice coming back to you slightly delayed. And it's a network artifact, I think, that happens on a lot of different network connections, voice connections, because you're calling somebody. They need to hear your voice. You need to hear their voice. But you may also get, in the round trip, a little bit of your voice back. Now, whether that's coming through the speaker or coming through digitally, I believe that's what's happening. And it happens with all voice over internet stuff. Now, UMA can be, and any solution in your home can be worse if you mess around with it. For instance, when you see that when you first get a UMA or a Magic Jack or any of these devices, they'll say, okay, now we want to be first on the modem. We don't want to be inside your router. We want to be outside your router. And I think that that can also exacerbate the echo you're getting if you're inside the router. So I would suggest when you install it that you follow the instructions carefully. That's going to minimize echo. And sometimes there's nothing you can do. It's just kind of in the nature of VoIP. We've had this problem for years. We beat our head against the wall with our own call system here and mostly licked it. And one of the ways we did that is by bringing the call system into the same studio. It was down in Southern California, and we think some of that echo was caused by some latency between us and Southern California. So latency can cause it. Packet routing problems can cause it. And even feedback, literally acoustic feedback from your caller. If your caller is talking to you, and a lot of people do this on open speakers. For instance, let's say you're making these phone calls. This happens a lot with Skype. Using your laptop and you use the microphone on the laptop, you're not wearing headphones, you're using the speakers. Skype has a lot of sophisticated technology to keep the sound from those speakers going back into the microphone and back to you. Every once in a while, you might hear it. They call it echo cancellation. That's an acoustic problem, not a digital problem that can also happen. So there's a lot of issues with voice over internet. Truth is, it works more often than it doesn't, and it works pretty well. And it works so well that your phone company is almost certainly using it now. In the earliest days of the phone system, you had a copper point-to-point connection with the person you were calling, even if it was across the country. And that's, I think, one of the reasons long-distance calling was so expensive. So remember in the early days of the Bell system, they had operators with jacks and plugs. And you're probably not old enough to remember picking up the phone and saying, and the operator coming on the line saying, number, please. Well, that's because you picked up the phone. That signaled the operator at the central office that you wanted to make a call. She took that jack, plugged it into your phone, and said, yeah, number, please. And then you'd give her the number. Then she'd take the other end of the jack and plug it into the other person's phone. And now completing the circuit, literally a copper wire circuit between you and the other person. Now, eventually, we eliminated the operators. At one point, they thought if we continue to use humans to do this, we'll run out of humans before we get this working. They said every woman in the United States will be employed as an operator for Ma Bell if we continue this way. So they created mechanical machines to do it. You may remember those big mechanical switches, chunk, 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 that did that in the phone office, and eventually digital switches, and eventually they eliminated the copper line entirely, and it was data only. So we're all using VoIP. This is VoIP. Everything's VoIP now. And VoIP has a few digital and acoustic artifact issues. You've probably heard the choppiness sometimes happens when packets get dropped or missing or go missing. Digital burbling you can get, all sorts of weird things. And echo is one of them. Only thing I can recommend, if you have a voice over the internet device, follow the instructions for installation carefully. And usually that means connecting it directly to your cable modem or your DSL modem before your router, if you can. 8888 Ask Leo, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We will digitally switch now to programming from another source before we return. Don't bother me. I'm playing the Google Doodle right now. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888. Ask Leo. Oh, my. The Google Doodle is fun. It's a Halloween doodle. You know that, right? If you go to Google.com. Originally, the Google Doodles were just these simple, you know, little cartoon drawings, usually to commemorate a geeky anniversary, you know, the anniversary of Tesla's birth or that kind of thing. But they've gotten more sophisticated and more sophisticated, and now they're just crazy. This one is a animated cartoon. You play a kitty cat, and you've got to defeat oncoming ghosts by drawing symbols, the symbol associated with each ghost. I'm at level two, but I guess I just have to stop right now. I'm sorry. not an easy game, but a lot of fun to play. Google.com. The first Google Doodle, says Steve in Baltimore, was to honor Burning Man. I did not know that. You can actually see all the Google Doodles from all time on the Google Doodles webpage, which is, I believe, google.com/doodles. Google.com/doodles. And you can go back through time and check out all the playable games, the videos, the toys, the cartoons, and I presume even go back to the very first Google Doodle. Must have been many, many moons ago. Google is now, what, 15 years old? Oh, boy, there's so many Google Doodles. It might take a long, long time. There's a Doodles archive. Do you think? I think it's a case. Originally, it was probably just, you know, a side project from somebody at Google. You know, I can imagine. You know, one of the engineers says, hey, what if we put this on the search page? I'll draw a picture to celebrate Mother's Day. But now it must be, they must have a whole team doing it, right? There's a Google Doodle almost every day. 88, yeah, apparently Web 520 in the chat room says, yes, there's a dedicated Google Doodle team of web designers and artists working full time. That'd be, you know, it'd be kind of hard. Like if you tell your mother, honey, what are you doing these days? Well, I got a job, Mom. I'm working at Google. Oh, Google! How exciting! Are you writing the search tools? No, Mom. Are you perhaps working on self-driving cars? No, Mom. I do the Google Doodle. Oh. I'm just going to say you work for Google, if you don't mind. 8888 Ask Leo. Antonio in Chico is next. Hi, Antonio.
Hey, Leo. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, I really like using Linux Mint just because when you install it, everything works right out of the box.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know like 8 months ago, I know the ISOs got hacked and
yeah,
had some issues. And I was wondering, is it safe to use Linux Mint
for
primary system?
Absolutely. So let me talk a little bit about this. First of all, I promised I'd speak English. So let's define terms. When you use a computer, you have to have an operating system on that computer. So you could do things like open programs, copy files, that kind of thing. Most people use Windows. That's an operating system. Many use Macintosh. That's an operating system. But back in the early 90s, a graduate student named Linus Torvalds decided to create a new operating system called Linux. It's supposed to look a little bit like the ancient graybeard operating system called Unix. It was created by AT&T in the 70s. And in fact, it is perhaps now the most widely used version of Unix. It's not a true Unix, but it is so close, you might as well call it a Unix. In the world, many web servers use it. If you use an Android phone, that's running on Linux. If you use Chrome OS, a Chromebook, that's running on Linux. And because Linus did not keep, you know, the Linux code, but gave it away, made it open source, made it available for others and encouraged others to work on it. He kept the trademark, so he has to approve it. Something can't be called Linux unless Linus says, yeah, that's Linux, which is good for quality control, but he gave everything else away. And so there are many, many versions now of Linux, all ultimately based on Linus's approved kernel base operating system, and then with different things added on top of it, applications, user interfaces, installers, that kind of thing. So the most popular version of Linux right now is Ubuntu, U-B-U-N-T-U. It was created by a former dot-com millionaire, Mark Shuttleworth, who formed a company called Canonical in South Africa. And Ubuntu is very, very popular. But there were people who didn't like the direction Ubuntu took in terms of user interface, and they created a form of Ubuntu called Mint, which is really based on the cinnamon, I love the flavors here, the cinnamon desktop and some other modifications, to the experience. Mint is a great choice for people who want something, as you said, that's easy to install, that's very Windows-like. If you're coming from Microsoft Windows or even Macintosh, you'd feel right at home. But it's only one of a great many of versions of Linux out there.
I tried like Debian, but certain things out of the box, I couldn't get the Wi-Fi to work.
Right.
It just seemed like Mint worked right out of the box.
Yeah, Debian, it's interesting, is one of the oldest versions of Linux and is what Ubuntu's based on. So really, there's a lineage here. The folks who do Debian, that's a community effort, not a corporate effort. They do Debian, they modify programs, they update it and so forth. Then that Debian core is taken by the Ubuntu folks, who then put their flavor on top of it. And that Ubuntu is taken by the Mint folks. And this is my only complaint about Mint, is really it's a derivative of a derivative. Debian, of course, being the root, would be the most kind of cleanest, purest version. But you're exactly right. One of the things that Canonical adds with Ubuntu and then the Mint folks add with Mint is ease of use. So, yes, it's completely safe. In my opinion, they've done a good job. There have been complaints about Mint not taking security. So this is the whole problem in general, is you want to get, if there's a flaw in a program on your operating system, you want to get it patched in a timely way. In my opinion, Debian is probably, if you're going to want a secure operating system, Debian Stable is probably the best. But as you go upstream to Ubuntu and then to Mint, it becomes increasingly unlikely that you're getting all of the fixes. You see what I'm saying? In my opinion, it's not a problem. I don't use Mint, though, for that reason. I do use Debian. You know, I have been lately using a version of Linux that is as easy to install as Mint, is a rolling distro, which means it gets all the updates in very prompt fashion, which could cause stability issues from time to time. But I really like it. And I think, and you can, by the way, use the Cinnamon desktop. That's available. It's called Entergos, Antergos. Use Mint. If you like Mint, stick with it. I think Linux is a great choice. It's free, it's kept up to date, and it can do anything that any computer can do. Sometimes a little more effort, perhaps, than a Windows or a Mac. Sometimes a little bit less. It's a little bit more reliable. But no, yes, it's to answer your question specifically, Mint is great. Safe to use. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Chris Marquardt.
Hey, Leo, how are you?
Great to see you. Chris is a digital photography and film photography guru.
Leave the digital out. It's photography.
Photography.
It's just photography.
He's the guy who persuaded me to buy film cameras, among others, and has published a great book on film photography. In fact, I highly recommend it for photography in general. And you'll find that in his workshops and his work at discoverthetopfloor.com. What do you want to talk about today?
Well, we still have a secret superpower. This time a bit of a different one. You know how sometimes you see pictures that have a ton of feeling, that tell a wonderful story, but that are kind of technically off? Have you ever had that? You look at a picture that's, I don't know, blurry,
all
out of
the
focus,
time.
Motion blurred, or it's
motion blurred all the time.
And but still, you will often find that there is something to it. It has that special something. And it's kind of hard to explain. There's some, let's say, some ephemeral quality to some of those
photos.
Sometimes
a technical issue adds to the emotion. I think of Henri Cartier-Bresson, the great French photographer.
Yeah, but well, he shot with Leica, so he wasn't using subpar equipment. But
no, but
he
sometimes
shot in
be
black
blurry
and white,
stuff
and some of the pictures are a bit blurry. Yeah,
but
That quality doesn't come from technical brilliance. It doesn't come from perfect exposure or perfect focus or perfect colors, but sometimes rather the opposite. It seems sometimes it's rather the opposite that these, I don't even know how to say it, the wrong photos, for lack of a better word, create a lot more emotion than the ones that are technically perfect. And now the first question that I would ask myself at this point is, well, first of all, why and then how? How can we do this? So why first? The out of focus pictures. You know how we use focus to guide the eye in a photo? So we want to look where the focus is. But if you don't have the focus where it kind of feels natural, that will add something to the picture, some tension to the picture. And also getting the focus wrong will reduce detail in the picture. So you have less detail in the picture that you can work with. Motion blur, pretty much the same thing. Well, of course, it emphasizes motion. So if you move the camera while shooting, or if you have something that moves in your viewfinder while you shoot a picture with a longer exposure time, that will, again, add some blur and some, it reduces detail again. Or the colors. If the colors are off, or actually even better, if you have no color at all, if it's a black and white picture, that takes detail out of the picture. Overexposure. Again, along the same lines, overexposure can give a shot some freshness. I mean, a bright picture usually has something positive about it most of the time. But also takes some detail out, because all of a sudden you have areas that don't have any detail at all.
It's kind of funny because we work so hard to get pictures technically good, right?
Yes.
That becomes, in fact, for me, knowing how to use my camera so that I can expose pictures properly and focus them properly and get them technically good, yes, is the first thing I do. And yet, you're absolutely right. Sometimes pictures with flaws are emotionally more exciting. They're better images, right?
Same with underexposure. Reduction of detail means that you will, it comes down to that, reduction of detail. You will paint in broader strokes. You will have some information missing. And that sort of a picture will force the viewer to fill in the missing detail in their mind. It forces them to complete the picture. It's like a piece of the puzzle is missing. If you have a puzzle in front of you and there are a few pieces missing, you will still recognize the picture. So you will fill in the blank, but you'll have to do some work. And that is one of the secrets of why these photos work really well. By the way, there are a few examples out there. Check out the website of Susan Bernstein. My better half, Monica, discovered that photographer. Susan Bernstein, BURNSTINE.com. Susan Bernstein, she takes that to an extreme level, because the photos she does, she actually builds her own cameras for that weird things, and these photos are so reduced, so out of focus, so weird, but I look at them and I love them.
Paintings, right?
Dreams. They're pretty much like dreams, you know?
Painting itself evolved from hyper-realism to expressionism to complete abstract, and so photography can do the same.
Right. So the secret superpower, how to get there, how to find out how you can do this. Unfortunately, most of the other secret superpowers, like how to shoot lightning or how to shoot the stars and stuff, I had some rules there. Now here, it's kind of hard to come up with firm rules or with a formula. But I mean, the first thing that you have to do if you want to go in this direction is to shut up the little guy in your head. That little guy that tells you that you're not doing it right. You know, there's this instance that says, hey, stop, this is wrong, don't do it. And if you manage to learn to ignore that voice, it's the first step in the right direction. Second step, turn off the auto mode in your camera. I mean, dare to try shoot in manual. It might be so scary, but the camera, in that context, the camera is actually working against you, because it tries to get technical perfection. It will focus for you. It'll try to avoid shake by keeping the shutter speed low. It'll try to get the best colors it can and the best exposure it can. So you'll have to kind of turn off the automatic settings and shoot in manual to get there. And the next, I think, really important part is play. It's really as simple as that. Play with it. Try it out. Turn the wheels in one direction. Turn them in the other direction and see what happens. And you will instantly get those wacky results, like motion blur. You get longer shutter speeds than usual. Like, set it on a tenth of a second instead of a thousandth of a second, and all of a sudden, when you move the camera, you will get interesting streaks, like streaks of lights in the picture when you shoot in the dark with lights on, like on a Christmas tree, for example, or overexposure. If you make the shutter speed longer than usual, same with the motion blur, you will get more light in, and the picture will get brighter, and you will get a different result than you would usually get. So that's pretty much what this comes down to. Play, trust your gut, and yeah, don't worry, you can't really break anything.
I like it. Remember, it's art. And there are no rules in art, right?
I mean, we're not journalists here. We're trying to make something that looks pleasing, that feels nice, and for that, it's totally fine. And even if the only thing you take away from that is that you can do it if you want to and go back to your automatic settings, but let the camera try to outsmart the camera a bit, because the camera is too smart most of the time.
Well, most of the time, what you want is an accurate reproduction of what you see. Yeah. But every once in a while, maybe we can get a little wild.
A little bit more daring. Yeah. You won't really break the camera.
Use your thumb to paint instead of a paintbrush. Chris Marquardt at Discover the Top Floor. As I said, great photo workshops. I got to create some time to go on one of your trips. I want to go. You just did that one, the sailboat one to Greenland, right?
Yeah, we're going back there probably in 2018.
All right, 2018. So. We're going to Greenland on a sailboat. DiscoverTheTopFloor.com to learn more. And don't forget, I'll tell you about our assignment when we come back. Thank you, Chris.
Absolutely.
See you next week. We'll do a photo assignment next week. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Greenland and sailboats forever. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo, our assignment, we do this every month or so. Chris Marquardt gives us a word or a concept to illustrate with our photography. I'm not going to be too specific about what it means. The word is scale, although it's my sense that Chris isn't looking for snake skins or weighing yourself. He's looking more for kind of scale in terms of size, okay? And here's how it works. Just take a picture. It doesn't have to be with a fancy camera by any means, any camera. Camera phones are fine. And pick one that illustrates it and you think is a good picture, is worth paying attention to. And you can tag it with the word scale and upload it to Flickr and then submit it to the Tech Guy group on Flickr. And Renee Silverman, who moderates the group, will say thank you, welcome you. I think you can submit one a week, so you probably only can do one if you haven't done any yet between now and next Sunday. Chris is going to pick three images from the pile of images at the Tech Guy group on Flickr and talk about them. Scale. I know that's a pretty broad term, but I think Chris is thinking more in terms of size. It's a great opportunity to have some fun with your camera. There's no prize or anything. It's just fun. 8888 Ask Leo, the number. Judith is on the line Justin is on the line from Oxnard, California. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Leo. I talked yesterday with you about switching to Windows.
Okay.
And I was wondering, I'm deciding between two computers, and I don't know which one to get.
Okay.
It's the XPS 13 and the Vio Z.
Well, my personal preference by far, the XPS 13 from Dell. I think it's widely considered to be the best Windows computer out there. Certainly there are perhaps others, but this is, and I have several XPS 13s, and I love
it. Reliable?
Very reliable. The edge-to-edge screen is second to none. There's only one negative, in my opinion, on the XPS 13. Is that in order to do that bezel-less display, which is gorgeous and fully touch, by the way, and I would get the touch version, The camera has to be at the bottom of the screen, which means if you're using that camera for Skype or whatever, it's going to be an up-the-nose shot for most of the time. You have to be aware of that and maybe adjust the computer or the screen a little bit. And that's the only negative. And if you don't use Skype or do video conferencing a lot, then I wouldn't worry about it. I think that's a lot better than the Vaio. I'm not a big fan of the Sonys, to be honest. And frankly, I don't think Sony wants to stay in the PC business anyway.
I think Sony sold off the business.
That's right.
Vaio.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's stay away from that. That's an orphaned system. Dell is in the business for the long haul, and I really like what they're doing. So that's strong recommendation. Strong recommendation for Dell. I really like Dell's stuff in general. Sometimes people say, and I don't think that this is unfair, that it's uninspired design. The Dells tend to look kind of industrial. You know what? Normally, I have not been a fan of HP's laptops. Not so much because of poor design, but because HP tended to lard them up with trialware. I hate that on Windows. And often had unreliable hardware. But, of course, HP has kind of separated now into two divisions. The PC division is on its own. And I think they decided to turn over a new leaf. And they've done some really beautiful stuff. I wouldn't get the least expensive HPs, the Streams. They're too cheap to be reliable, in my opinion. A good computer, you're going to spend more than you'd probably like, you know. But I bought the HP Spectre 13T. This is a design-wise, really a tour de force, thinner than the MacBook. It's at the time, and I suspect still, the thinnest laptop computer made. Had beautiful coppery hinges and just really nice. Did not have a touch screen. That was a negative. And unfortunately, even though it had three Type-C ports, including two Thunderbolt 3 compatible Type-C ports, it required the use of an HP proprietary charger, unnecessarily in my opinion. But other than that, a really nice machine, and it runs Linux beautifully, as do all the Dells. That's another good reason to go with the XPS line. Dell had an engineer a few years ago who really wanted them to support Linux. They created the Sputnik project. And that means drivers. There are good Linux drivers for all the Dell hardware. You can even buy an XPS. They call it the Ubuntu edition with Linux on it. Even if you don't, though, you can buy a Windows version. It'll easily accommodate Linux, any version of Linux, at some point if you decide to switch from Windows to Linux. Another great reason, in my opinion, to support Dell. Back to the phones. Diane Long Beach. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you?
Oh, fine. Thank you. I need to pick your brain today on a couple of things.
Well, let me take my hat off if you're going to pick my brain. All right. Go ahead.
Well, I want to cut my cable. My cable bill is way too high. So talking to a couple of people, they've been telling me different things, and I just want to know what works best. They've said the Roku Stick, Kodi, Sling TV.
So unfortunately, there's no one solution that works for everything.
Uh-huh.
We're in this kind of interim state where television is, in general, is moving from broadcast and cable to data, to the internet. Once it gets there, this is going to be a no-brainer. But for now, what you're saying when you're saying cut the cable is you're going to get your TV over the internet.
Yeah.
That usually means you have a device that hooks up to your TV that gets internet. But none of these devices gets the whole internet, and that's very frustrating. For instance, if you buy music or movies or TV shows on Apple's iTunes, the only way to put it on your television set is with an Apple TV box. If you buy Amazon, you can't use an Apple TV box. You have to use a Roku or an Android device. It's very confusing. I agree, though, with your friends. Roku, in general, if you're going to pick one, is the best device to attach to your TV to give it the broadest possibility of internet. And the Stick, I'm not crazy about. The Stick is compact, but I think as a result, it has overheating issues. I would get one of the little Roku Pucks. They're just a little bit more reliable. My Stick would crash frequently. But the nice thing, but they're under $100. And the nice thing about the Rokus is you get the broadest variety of content. Now, an interesting thing is starting to happen. Sony PlayStation has created a subscription service called View. CBS is doing this. Amazon is doing this. A number of companies are creating what basically look like cable subscription packages designed to replace your cable, but it's all over the internet. See, the problem with cable cord cutting is you don't get your local stations.
Right, and that was my other question. How do I do
so
that?
In some cases, for instance, the Sony View in some markets does give you cable, channel 4, 5, 7, whatever the local stations are. In some cases, there's a new service that was just announced that is going to be very low cost from AT&T. They call it DirecTV Now, I think. And that's going to be $40. That looks like it'll have 100 channels. In other words, they're starting to get to the point where they're almost comparable to cable. It's those live locals that are going to be the biggest problem. But if you get the Roku, you can get the PlayStation View app on it. I'm sure we'll be able to get the AT&T DirecTV Now app on it. So that will solve that problem. The question is for you is which hardware to start with. And I would start, I think you have the right instinct. Start with the Roku, R-O-K-U. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. The Tech Guy podcast this week brought to you by, I love these guys at Atlassian. We use Atlassian like crazy. If you're a programmer, you know the name because they do Jira, which is the most amazing way to create an agile team. Keep track of what you're up to, move stuff from in production to from development to production. We used Jira a lot during the development of our new website. It was our first introduction. That's how we got to know HipChat, another Atlassian product that works beautifully with Jira. And then our IT team started using Confluence to document processes and workflows and all of that. And now they're going to be using the new IT support product from Atlassian. It's called Jira Service Desk. If you're tired of clunky support tools that are a pain to use, who in our chat room yesterday, Odin and some others were saying that they used another product. I won't name the name. Not Atlassian, not Jira Service Desk, but another kind of IT support tool. And they said they hated it. If you hate the tools you're using, you've got to try Jira Service Desk, the modern way to keep track of what's going on, to serve your customers, to stay on top of service level agreements, to help your agents be productive, from putting out fires to helping employees get stuff done, automate repetitive tasks, you have to do the same thing over and over again. Isn't that the definition of insanity? Don't do that. Focus on the important stuff. Use Jira Service Desk for as little as $10 a month. Everything your IT team needs. And of course, it integrates beautifully with Confluence. It integrates beautifully with HipChat. We use Confluence, as I mentioned, to automate workflows or to document automated workflows. Now we're going to build a support knowledge base so your support team has all the answers they need for your customers' questions. You could track projects with Jira Service Desk, just as you do with Jira, so you could see what tasks, what people are assigned to each project, watch it move from concept to implementation to the final product. Just fabulous. I want you to try it right now. Get Jira Service Desk from Atlassian, of course, atlassian.com/twit. And by the way, if you sign up for that free demo, atlassian.com/twit, first 100 people to do that today will get a free Konami Code t-shirt. You're going to love it. What is it? Up, up, down, down, left, right, A, B, A, B. For IT support. See why over 20,000 and counting IT teams love Jira Service Desk. Free 7-day trial and t-shirt if you hurry at atlassian.com/twit. And we thank them so much for making the Tech Guy podcast possible. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, cord cutting, autonomous vehicles, virtual reality, and more. 888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. That's my number, toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada outside that area. You can still reach us. Just use your favorite VoIP client and call that number. 888-ASK-LEO. We were talking about cord cutting. It's a topic that we talk about a lot and can go on and on and on about. The issue, of course, is that many of the channels you want to watch are not yet available on the internet, in particular your local stations. a lot of local stations haven't quite figured out how this would work because much of their program is networking programming. And the networked, that ABC, CBS, NBC, CW, and all the others are themselves have their own internet plays, and they're reluctant to put, allow a local station to put that. It's just a mess. And many of the cable channels are nervous about putting themselves on the internet because they don't want to annoy the cable companies who right now are their bread and butter. They bring those channels to you over the cable. But cord cutting is all about eliminating cable fees and replacing it with data fees only. Of course, what Comcast and other companies that do that, they're both in both businesses, is they've slowly increased the cost of data, so that it ends up being a push. That's what's going to happen, by the way. you don't cord cut to save money, because if you think about it, first of all, you got to pay for your internet. Nowadays, with cable companies, that's $60 a month, maybe more, maybe a little less. Let's say forty to sixty. Then you have to start paying for the additional channels. You can get HBO without a cable subscription. They call it HBO Now. What is that? $15 a month. Showtime Anywhere. That's what is that? Another $10 a month. ESPN. You can get that through Sling TV. By the time you add it all up, it's going to cost you exactly the same as your cable bill, and that's not an accident. That's exactly what the cable companies want, right? So cord cutting is not, at this point, a way to save money. But it does give you some more flexibility, you know. And it's interesting to see companies like AT&T that are in the pipe business start to offer packages like this new DirecTV Now. It'll be out, we think, next month. In fact, maybe soon. I saw one leak that said November 4th. That's 5 days from now. These companies are trying to have it both ways. And this is what happens. This is what technology has done. This is something you should be used to at this point, which is companies that are not digital trying to figure out a way to become digital safely without bankrupting their primary business until they can safely transition over. It is a juggling act. It's not easy. Companies like Kodak that had, a very good business. Kodak had a great business in film and developing, right, and processing. And they saw digital coming. They knew. In fact, they even made some of the earliest digital cameras. They knew it was coming. They didn't. It wasn't that they didn't plan for this. They created a site called, I think it was Ophoto, designed to store your images. They tried to make the transition. They ended up going bankrupt anyway because it turned out there's not as much money in digital as there is in film and processing. And their business was based on the profits that were generated by film and processing. So even if you know it's happening, the internet didn't sneak up on you. You planned for it. You prepared for it. You could still have a rough time in the transition. And that's exactly what the cable companies are worried about. The content companies are trying to figure out. It's not easy. That's why Walmart, for instance, big brick and mortar, right? I mean, they made all their money in stores that you go to and you pick up stuff. But they see Amazon coming down the pipe at them. So it's why they acquired an online retailer for perhaps more money than it was worth, because they want to be in that game without giving up their, primary means of income. So we shall see. We shall see what happens. It's a very interesting time, and as it always is when you have these kinds of dramatic transitions. It's tough for humans too, right? Because, when companies struggle, the humans that work in those companies end up taking the brunt of it. The people who worked at Kodak were out of work. And you're seeing a lot of that as well. At transitional times, what's the Chinese proverb? May you live in interesting times. They're interesting. For a tech journalist, they're maybe even invigorating. But for real people who have to, for instance, about 1.5% of all the people in the United States make their livings, 1.5% of us make our livings driving. driving trucks, driving cabs, driving. But what's coming down the pipe? Maybe faster than we even imagine. Cars and trucks that drive themselves. This week, the first autonomous truck made the first delivery, 50,000 cans of Budweiser beer, delivered by a truck that drove itself. There was a driver in it, but he didn't have his hands on the wheel or his feet on the pedals. This truck, using software called Otto, O-T-T-O, made its first delivery this week. Now, that's if you're in the business of driving a truck, that's a very chilling fact. But one of the reasons that Otto did this, one of the reasons this company is doing this, and Budweiser did it, is because they're having a hard time finding drivers, believe it or not. There are far more positions for truck drivers open than there are drivers to drive them. The truck drove through Colorado, 55 miles an hour, drove itself, left the brewery in Fort Collins, Colorado at 12:30 in the morning. Once it had merged onto the interstate, you needed a real human to do that. The driver punched a switch, engaging Otto, and the truck continued 120 miles south to Colorado Springs, all by itself. By the way, Otto is owned by, who do you think? Uber. Of course it is. And if you're an Uber driver, this might be a little scary. Again, we live in interesting times. I'm a little more, frankly, I'm scared. I would hate, how would you feel if you drove by this truck and there was no one at the wheel? No human inside. Elon Musk said we're putting in all the hardware to make Tesla's self-driving starting now. Software will have to be added later. But he says, soon we'll be twice as safe as a human driver. Twice as safe as a human driver. Now, by the way, that's still not safe enough, in my opinion, because human drivers are terrible. So being only half as terrible is probably not quite good enough yet. I want to see them make no accidents. And my goodness, if you see a 18-wheeler barreling down the highway at you and there's no one at the wheel, yikes. A little scary. 8888-ASK-LEO. We'll get back to the phones in just a little bit. We can talk about this if you want. Or anything. Most of the time, I think what people call with is problems. Like, my computer won't work. My phone won't work. How do you do this? How do you do that? And usually we find the solutions. Yesterday, we had a caller who said, I can't buy a smartphone until I find one that can auto-answer itself. You know, the phone rings twice and it picks up. Most people wouldn't want that, but he does. And we found the answer. And as always the case, I didn't get it on the air, but we did get it in the website. So if you hear something and you want to know more, techguylabs.com. TechGuyLabs.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. Now I've gotten in a fight with the chat room because we were saying, somebody in the chat room, I think this was quite astute, said, well, we already, in a way, have self-driving trucks. They're called trains. And that maybe was where we went wrong, as in replacing trains with trucks. Of course, train tracks only go to a limited number of places, right? You still need something to take it from the train station to the store. But then we started getting in a battle over how much an engineer of a train does. Couldn't a computer do everything an engineer does today? He's not steering. You could have, I would imagine, now, and I certainly don't, if you're an engineer of a train, maybe you can set me straight on this, but I would imagine everything could be done electronically. Slow down at this curve. Here we are in the station. Slow down to this speed. Stop here. Steering, I would think, would be the hardest thing. Lane changes and stuff like that. But that could all be done, in a train. There's no steering. It's really basically how fast you go and whether you stop or not. 8888-ASK-LEO. But I am willing to be proven wrong. I certainly don't want to invalidate anybody's job. Except if I were a railroad engineer, I might be thinking about other lines of work right now. 8888 Ask Leah. Let's go to Shar in Los Angeles. Hi, Shar.
Hi, Mr. LaPointe. How are you today?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. I'm saving up to buy the iPhone 7 Plus.
Okay.
But the research I've been doing on it says it doesn't have a spot to put in your, your audio input.
It doesn't. They got rid of the headphone jack. What is that? Is it crazy or what?
I know,
but they still have a hole in the bottom, and that is what Apple calls their lightning port. Only Apple makes it or uses it, but the lightning port can do everything. So when you get an iPhone 7, you'll get regular headphones, but they have a lightning connector at the bottom instead of a the headphone jack, and they put an adapter in there that will take a standard headphone jack and turn it into lightning. So you could take, if you have another pair of headphones you use, you can put them into that and plug that into the phone. So now the only real limitation is that when you're doing, there is only one port on the phone, the lightning port. So you can't listen to headphones and charge at the same time. So if that's something you do a lot, maybe on an airplane or when you're going to bed, that kind of thing, then you have to get an additional doohickey. And Apple makes those as well, or other companies do, that allows you to both charge and listen at the same time.
Okay.
I don't find it, I was the first to criticize it. I think it's crazy for Apple to do that, and I don't think they've really justified it. But you get over it pretty quick. What I ended up doing, the adapters are about $9. So what I ended up doing is buying a few extra adapters, see, even more to save. A few extra adapters so that I put them on the headphones that I use with my phone. The other thing is Apple's hoping you will start using wireless headphones, Bluetooth headphones. And they've created they're going to create new Bluetooth headphones designed to work better with the iPhone than with other phones, they say. So that's the other side of it. And guess who the number one Bluetooth headphone manufacturer in the whole wide world is? Apple.
Apple. Wow. Apple. Imagine that.
Imagine that. So, Apple says, in fact, they very specifically said when they announced it that it took courage for them to take out the headphone port. They thought it was the right thing to do, but it was a courageous thing to do. Yeah, courage or profit, one or the other for sure.
For sure.
It's an expensive phone, right? I mean, you're saving up a lot of money to buy this phone.
Yeah, it's very expensive.
I think it's like beautiful. I'm holding it right now. Maybe you can tell. It's beautiful. I got the jet black one, the shiny black one, and it's almost you feel like it should be in the Museum of Modern Art. I mean, it is a gorgeous phone. Whether it's a better phone than any other phone that costs less, well, that's really more a judgment for you. Technically, right. Probably not.
Well, I've never owned an iPhone, so this will be my first.
Do you use Android phones?
Yes.
Yeah. So there are much less expensive Android phones. Ironically, Google makes a phone, the Pixel, and it's exactly the same price as the iPhone. So it seems like they all just want to take our money.
Yes.
You know?
I think so.
You know? I'm a little disappointed by that, but what can I say? This is, if you're going to use it for several years, the fact that it costs almost $1,000, well, I guess you divide it by 36 months. It's not. It's only $30 a month. That's not too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Think of it that way.
Yeah.
It is really beautiful.
I really want it. So it's
this is what Apple's good at, is making lust-worthy technology products, right? I have to have that. So
right.
Beautiful. Oh, I want that. I'm lucky. I have to buy everything. So I get to play with it all. I feel like you can survive the loss of the headphone jack. The bigger issue is how much it costs. And there are very good phones. I've been using the Axon 7, which is a Chinese made phone from a company called Huawei, Huawei. They made the last Google phone. It's a really great phone. $400, half as much as the iPhone. So there are other good choices out there. The Honor 8 is very good. The OnePlus 3 from OnePlus. These are all very, very good Android phones that cost half as much as the iPhone.
Okay. Yeah, but it's not an iPhone.
Yeah, so you'll get by without the headphone. It's not a big deal. It's a less of a big deal than I thought it was.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Or, Char, it's good to talk to you. Take
care.
8888-ASK. Leo, that is the phone number. If you want to call and talk, we also have a great website, techguylabs.com. That's free and easy and open to all. Anything I mention, all the links are there. More of your calls still to come. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. E-call. Let's go to next caller, Dick in Silverado Canyon, California. Hello, Dick.
Oh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hello, Master. What can I do for you?
First of all, that flavor of Linux you mentioned.
Yes.
Betty, booty, body.
So Ubuntu is certainly the most popular version of Linux out there.
Yeah.
Ubuntu. It's Swahili for some nice thing.
Okay.
I can't remember what the nice thing is. Like all of us working together to make the world a better place or something like that. Ubuntu. And it's available from ubuntu.com. What you're looking for, if you're looking at Linux, is something that it will work with a Windows machine and understand all the hardware. That's traditionally been kind of tricky in the past. But modern Linux versions generally have drivers for everything. One of the reasons I like Dell's, for instance, for Linux is Dell's made sure that all the drivers for its particular proprietary hardware are available and can be used with any Linux. And so that's a good one to start with, Ubuntu.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And
yes.
Now I have a solution for one of your callers.
Oh, that I thank you, thank you, thank you.
She was wondering about storage, and you gave her the word about Carbonite, which is good, but she also needed a local storage that would be reasonably burglar-proof.
Yeah, she wanted something. So, yes, exactly. Yeah.
And all she has to do is get in ye old Yeller pages and look up a place that sells used office furniture,
yeah,
including safes.
Right.
Office safes and secure file cabinets. There is a type of safe that has holes in it that are small enough to prevent fire from getting through. But you can put a wire in, and they're normally used in companies and government agencies to contain crypto boxes. So the cryptographic boxes are secure in that safe.
Yes.
And
But they're still connected via USB or FireWire,
yes,
whatever it is, because you can get a cable through the safe.
Right.
Wall.
You can get the appropriate cable through it, and it's fireproof, it's burglar-proof, you don't want to drop it on your foot, and it will work like a champ. And besides, in addition to all of that, I'm a helicopter pilot.
Ah! Are you a locksmith and a helicopter pilot, or just to know a little bit about safes?
No, I just know a little bit about safes because in my work, I work with the contents of those safes.
Now, what kind of helicopters do you fly? Is it a commercial pilot? Do you do tours?
Oh, I haven't. I'm old and retired and haven't flown in years.
Former helicopter pilot.
Yes, in the Army.
They're safe, right?
Absolutely.
They're just
they fly on the principle of trying to tear themselves apart.
Yeah, they're just a stone with some ballistics.
By the way, I'm also a W1 November Zulu.
W6TWT 73. Hey, I got a question for you.
Okay.
What's this Yellow Pages you're talking about? And where do I get that?
YP.com.
There's a company that saw the writing on the wall. Although, if I'm not mistaken, I think I still get a phone book delivered to me once a year. Do I not? Or do they stop doing that?
They're going to for a while, but it will disappear.
And I wonder, who is it that's using the Yellow Pages of the phone book anymore? And
lot of people.
Do they?
Believe it or not.
Yeah.
People don't want to have to carry a computer around in their office all the time to look up a phone number of, you know, Joe Blow Supply Company.
Sure.
Now, there are two versions of Yellow Pages.
Yeah.
One is the type that you and I would look to find somebody to fix your shoes or boots. And the other is called business to business.
Yes, of course. Now, that I understand. If you're in a business, we still have directories in my business, the real guides that give you the names of lighting gaffers and film editors and things like that. So I can understand specialized directories, although increasingly, really, who doesn't have access to the internet? Come on.
Well, you're pretty much right, but I'm a holdout. I do not have a smartphone.
What?
I don't plan to get one.
Good man. There needs to be somebody in this country who can make a phone call when all the operating systems are broken.
Absolutely. I've got a sign on my door to anchor risk or mudgeon.
Actually, that's really what hams are most useful for. Those weird digits and numbers and letters we just exchanged were our ham call signs. Yep. Amateur radios and amateur radio operators are very focused on emergency preparedness and providing communications when everything else is down.
And just this year, there was a congressman mentioned that when all else fails, there will be ham radio.
Absolutely. They're the cockroaches of the communications world. It's nice to talk to you, Dick, and thank you for the update. You're right. Yeah. Those fireproof safes with a USB port. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, man. That's one thing. When I retire, I'm learning Morse code. I'm going to on the air as a CW operator. I've always wanted to do that. I think it would be so much fun.
Good. Well, that was 7-3 that I just sent.
Nice. He can sing it. He can sing it. Thank you, Dick. 7-3. Take care. He had to do a code for a code, 7-3, which is code for regards. Hams. Is there anything they can't do? Let's see, Chris in Florida. Hi, Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I'm a little nervous. Sorry about that.
No, don't be nervous. It's just you and me. And a few million other strange people. Yep. But they all are rooting for you.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to believe.
Well, that's what I tell myself every morning when I get up. I hope it's true.
Well, it probably is in your case.
No, it's almost certainly not. But what can I do for you?
I have an iPhone 6, and ever since I got to iOS 10 and now 0.1, whenever I do a reset of the device, normally you're supposed to get a black screen and then a white apple.
Right.
I'm getting multicolored screens, yellow at the top, green at the bottom, green at the top, purple at the bottom, and Apple has no answer for this question. So.
I'm guessing almost certainly that you are seeing the first symptoms of something called touch disease, and it did in fact infect iPhone 6s, and it was caused by a faulty video chip, or not really faulty, but a chip that wasn't protected enough from the kinds of stresses that a phone goes through, from bending and putting it in your pocket. And eventually what happens is the video chip starts to misbehave, initially with strange lines, and I wouldn't be surprised. If you ever see, when the screen is on normally, a white or gray line at the top of the screen?
No.
And you don't notice sometimes that the touch becomes un or less responsive?
No.
All right. Maybe you don't have that. But I would guess it's related. When you see those colors, it's because the video card is spewing errant nonsense onto the screen. And that sounds to me like an abnormal behavior. I've never seen that in an iPhone. And apparently neither has Apple. So there's nothing to do. It's probably fine. If it gets worse, then you want to bring it to Apple. And I think it will be related to this problem called touch disease. You can Google it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You can see it in the booting process in this video. It's not colored, though. He said they were colored. But see, let's do this. I'll rewind this. You see, it's got the white Apple, and then it's got the gray flickering lines at the top. I would guess the colored lines are just another flavor of the same kind of. You see that when he touches it? And that's because he's touching right there where the chip is. And so the chip has a little short in it. And it's producing kind of spurious data on the screen. Apple, to date, has not acknowledge that this exists, although everyone in the world has and knows it is, and it's, there's too many cases of it. According to this article, when did this article come out from Business Insider? October 3rd, so it's a month old. Apple has never officially acknowledged the problem, but independent iPhone repair vendors and Apple Store technicians have said that it is easily one of the most common features that people need to fix. There were some class action lawsuits filed in California and Canada last month over this. Now, it's a 6 plus. I think he said it was a 6 he had, right? So I'm not sure. Boy, that seems related. Apple's warranty has expired on these phones, unless maybe you bought extended Apple Care. $329 to fix it. But some technicians say... Oh, I see. Motherboard talked to some current and former Apple Store technicians and reports if your phone is only slightly out of warranty. Well, but that's not the case, I think. You know, there are legal reasons why Apple isn't going to admit this. They should. If it's widespread, they absolutely should. But I think probably for legal reasons. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, day before Halloween. It's hard for me because I have been too old for Halloween for many decades now. I think it's great for the young people. I honor their desire for candy. And if they come to my door, I will not refuse them candy. And I generally remember, although I'm now realizing I haven't yet purchased candy, I generally have some form of candy for them at the door. And I always, you know, act appreciative of their costumes, even if I think they're dopey. But it's really seeped into our culture, hasn't it? You now have to wear a costume at work. When did that start happening? Right about when men stopped wearing hats on Main Street, I guess. But it's nuts. that's what it is. It's nuts. Anyway, I'm not wearing a costume today. I will wear a costume on some of our podcasts tomorrow because peer pressure. Last segment of the day. Let's get some calls in here before I run off and get my Halloween costume on. Gene is in North Hollywood, California. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Leo. I think I'm probably the only one in California that doesn't have a cell phone. But
you are. You're the last person. In fact, I've been meaning to talk to you, Gene.
I'm sick and tired of paying for my landline monthly phone. So I bought an Ooma.
Good.
But I don't know how to get it going.
Well, do you have internet access in your home?
Yes, but I have wired, modem?
You have a DSL modem. Okay.
Right.
And that should work fine.
The last time I tried to connect it, everything went off. Everything.
That's not what you want.
I had to go to a public phone to call customer service.
That's bad.
Horrible.
So, yeah, don't disconnect your landline until you get this Ooma thing working. I should tell you that there are things that Ooma is a category of product called VoIP, Voice Over Internet Protocol. That's the P.
Yeah, I heard you say that earlier.
Yeah, just think of voice over internet. And there are disadvantages to that compared to a landline. For instance, power goes out, phone goes out. Oh. Not true with a landline if it's not a plug-in, you know, landline. Mm-hmm. If you have just those old-fashioned princess phone that you just plug into the wall. If the internet goes out, your phone goes out. Not true of the landline. So they're less reliable. There's also the problem of 911. Because internet-based phones can be moved around, people sometimes take them with them as they travel. You can't, 911 isn't really sure where you are. Mm. And it's generally doesn't even work with the 911 systems. So they created something called E911 or electronic 911. And you need to register with your voice over internet provider and your location. And even then, if you make a 911 call, it may not go to your local 911. It probably will go to a regional 911, which then has to figure out where you are and route it properly. And if you're having a heart attack and seconds matter, this is not good. So I generally tell people, if you're going to do this, keep the least expensive landline you can get. And most phone companies will offer a pretty cheap landline, a Lifeline service style landline.
Oh, maybe I'll try that.
That way you've got a case of emergency. And 911 will work. If there's a storm and a power outage, if you have an old-fashioned phone that just plugs into the phone jack, it'll keep working because it gets its power from the phone company. If internet goes out, it'll keep working. Those are nice features. But Uma's fine. Now, the trick on Uma is you need a router. So
yes,
your cable...
Don't get a cheap router, but if it's just for the phone...
That's fine.
You're going to pay $500.
Yeah, because what you need is more than one jack. You have one for your computer coming out of your modem, right?
Right.
But you don't have a second one for the Uma. Oh. Is that the problem? A lot of times cable modems have more than one jack.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, there's one that's open. I have one.
Oh, then you don't need a router.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure. That means the cable, the DSL modem is a router. Now, you may need to configure your DSL modem to work with Uma. That's a little bit of a problem because guess who runs the DSL modem? Your phone company. They don't like Uma.
Yes. they possess the phone lines in my area.
Yeah. They may not. Now, they're technically supposed to help you, but they may be less than cooperative. Mm-hmm. Uma should be able to help you. In fact, if you call Uma, I don't know if they have support. But if they have support, you should be able to tell them, this is how my setup is. This is the DSL modem. This is this. And they should be able to tell you, oh, you need to do this, this, and this.
Okay.
There are VoIP routers that are designed for this, but I think your DSL modem has a router in it. Now, there are things that you need to do to the DSL modem settings-wise to make Uma work well. But Uma can help you. It's in their interest, right? Because you're a customer.
Yeah.
The phone company may not feel that way because they're afraid of losing you as a customer, right? So call Uma and be armed with what your setup is. Get the serial number of your modem or the brand name and the make of their modem from the back of it before you call because that's what they'll want to know. And then they'll probably online have somewhere that will walk you through it or you can call them.
Okay. One other thing.
Yeah.
Very shortly.
Sure.
What do you think about these? They had a real special phone, under $100, on the shopping channel. Everything. All you do is pay it. You get the phone. All you do is pay under $100. They give you 3 times text, 3 times data, 3 times calls or whatever.
And there's no monthly?
No. What's the catch?
Yeah, really. What's the catch? I don't know what the catch is, but I wouldn't do it.
It's a track phone.
Oh, that's a track phone. You do have a monthly. So that phone is $100.
Right.
But then in order for it to do anything, you have to call a phone company and they'll charge you. They may not charge you very much, but track phones you pay up front and you will have to continue to pay to continue to use it. So I think that read the fine print.
Mm-hmm.
The track phone is prepaid, what they call pay as you go. But that doesn't mean you stop paying. It means at some point they're going to say, okay, you want to keep using this phone, it'll be $30.
Oh, okay.
You pay for the minutes you use.
Right. Because they say if you run out of minutes and text and data, the next time you reload your phone, it'll be 3 times what you would normally get. 3 times.
Right. That may be true. They're cheaper. Because they're pay as you go, they don't have to worry about your credit rating. They probably buy service from another company like Sprint. Most often it's Sprint. I'm not sure who TrackPhone gets it from. But this is a prepaid wireless. In other words, you charge it up. Exactly that. So, obviously, as you use it, you'll need to put more. But it's a good phone if you just, because there's no contract. If you just want to put it in your glove compartment in case of emergency, that's a good choice.
Right.
As long as you just stick with calls, I think that's fine.
Oh, okay.
And they're not fancy phones, but they're smartphones. You'll be your
That's
first.
Why I don't have a cell phone because I don't like talking on the phone.
Yeah, well, I don't either. That's why I have a smartphone, because I can text, I can message, I can play games. I don't need to make a phone call.
Right.
Track phones, 120 minutes. I think it's not a bad. I'm looking at the track phone sites, TRACFONE. Mm-hmm. They can't spell, but that is a good deal. It really is for people who don't want to have a full service, full featured phone bill, and they don't want to pay the price either. So I think it's not a bad idea. Yeah. Perfect for you. It's just for emergencies. Put it in the glove compartment. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you to Michael Cozio, our musical director, with like just sterling effort today. Great Halloween stuff. And thanks also to Kim Schaffer answering the phones. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you have a wonderful Halloween and a great Geek Week. Happy Diwali if you're celebrating that. And if you're not, you should, because it's fun. And I will see you next week. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security and security now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.